Hello, this is Justin Veach, Associate Director of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear author Gregory Rodriguez discuss his new book, Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. This program was originally presented on November 13, 2007. For more information on Aloud, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Please welcome Gregory, and thank you very much.
I'm showing off mine, too. I had expected this to be a nice interview, I wouldn't have to do all the work myself. So I'm going to give you a version of a lecture I've been doing around the country, sometimes twice a day. But before I do that, I've noticed there are some people in the audience who, without whom I could not have written this book. My parents, Yolanda Chavez, who, as I say in my book, understood the thesis of this book long before I did. And Mira Geffner, the woman who did the, where are you, Mira? She disappeared. Who did the lion's share of the research at UCLA libraries, and she did the real hard work of transcribing and finding the work, so I'm really grateful to her. My book is essentially a history hidden in an argument, and it's really about what Mexican immigration will do in the long term in the U.S., and in order to do so, I think I've had to go back to the origins of Mexican history. In essence, my book is a look at the Mexican past as a way to see how it influences the American future. And my only notes for the night are the title of the book. And I think if I explain the title, then I've perhaps explained portions of the book that'll make you want to read it. Mexico has a very dysfunctional ethnic genesis myth. Mexico has mythologized as Hernán Cortés, the conqueror, and his mistress, Doña Marina La Malinche. And this is, it's a tragic tale. It's a tale of violence, of subordination, perhaps of love, perhaps of attraction. But it's a story that Mexico has itself turned on over time. And by the early 20th century, it had rejected its male progenitor. It's the symbol of its male progenitors in Cortés, So the Spaniards had become the conquerors who had destroyed the nation. And it had turned Doña Marina, the indigenous mistress, the translator without whom the conquest would have been much more difficult, if not impossible, into a traitor. And I won't use the stronger word that's used for her. That then, Octavio Paz wrote in the 1950s that Mexicans were orphans, that they had been stripped of their parentage from Spain and both the indigenous worlds, and hence were always in some sort of search for their origins. I then, in the last couple of weeks, I decided just to come out and do it, and I presented a new ethnic genesis myth, and some of you may have read it in the Los Angeles Times. And I'm sort of suggesting perhaps to Mexican Americans to embrace not just a tale of tragedy and conquest, but a tale of love and possibilities. And that is, and it comes straight out of an eyewitness account of the conquest in the 16th century, Bernal Diaz del Castillo's The Conquest of New Spain. And in it, you'll find that on landfall in 1519, when Cortes' men had reached the coast of Cozumel, they had met a friendly Mayan tribe, and I have no idea how they communicated with them. But through this communication, Cortes found out that there were two Christians in the neighboring land of Yucatan. Cortes immediately thought, we have to bring these men back to civilization. And he asked the Mayan chieftain, again, how did they communicate, to send some men to retrieve them. The chieftain refused, fearing that his men would be killed. Undeterred, Cortes sent two messengers with a load of trinkets with which to buy these men, presumably their captives, and a letter hidden in one man's beard. They reached the first man, Jerónimo de Aguilar, who was imprisoned. Aguilar, like his fellow Gonzalo Guerrero, who comes later in the story, were the two remaining survivors of a 1511 shipwreck. Aguilar presented the trinkets to his captor, and his captor said, "What the hell? Let him go. Seems to have been worth his freedom." And he was a sad story, and he prayed every day. I believe he had been a priest, and he later went on to actually help become a translator in the conquest. But he prayed each day and marked a calendar, and 8 years after having been survived a shipwreck, he thought it was Wednesday, and I believe it was a Sunday. And he was holding on to his Spanishness fiercely. Aguilar then set out with the two messengers to find Mr. Guerrero, who was living very close, about 15 miles away, but in very different circumstances. They met Guerrero, and he had been, at the time, he had already married a daughter of a Mayan chieftain. He was a captain in times of war. And they approached him, and he had tattoos. He had an earring. He had gone native, as they say. And the Spaniards said, "Come on, we'll take you back to civilization." And Guerrero balked, much to the surprise of his would-be liberators. And he said, "Well, you wouldn't accept me anymore. But look at me. I'm not you." And at one point in the conversation, Guerrero's Mayan wife screamed at him, "Who are these savages speaking the savage tongue, coming to take you away?" And Guerrero then got straight to the point at that point. He felt a bit rushed, I think. And he said, "I can't go with you. I can't go back. Because look at my children, how beautiful they are. Que mira mis hijos, que bonitos son." That is the first documentation of the mestizo in Mexico. That is the historically first documentation of the mixed people of Mexico. Now, the conquest of New Spain, as Mexico was called then, was not so beautiful or pretty. And as the Spaniards imposed control after the conquest, they sought to separate the races. They sought to establish a very clean, rigid racial system by which the Spaniards would live here and the indigenous communities would live here, and they were called repúblicas. There was a República de los Españoles and a República de los Indios, and they were not to have mixed. The Crown sought this because the Spaniards were a minority in an indigenous majority country, and not unlike places like the Mississippi Delta in the South, which were majority black from the 1860s on, and whites retrenched out of fear of the majority population. The Spaniards sought to separate themselves in towns and move the Indians outward. The church sought segregation as well, but for different reasons. They sought to protect the Indians from what they thought were the horrible moral corruption that the Spaniards brought to Indians and the abuses that the Spaniards brought to Indians. There was a third element of colonial society that didn't see it either way, the encomenderos, those conquerors who had received encomiendas, large tracts of land with tens of thousands of Indians to work that land. They sought to have the Indians near. They sought to have them as labor close to the Spaniards. This led to the natural mixing of these societies that were not to have mixed. Woodrow Borah, the late Woodrow Borah, one of the great scholars of colonial Latin America at Berkeley, in fact, said that the mestizo, the mixed person of Mesoamerica, was born of debt peonage. They were born of a labor system that brought these people together against the wishes of both the crown and the church. Over time, this mixture continued at the lower levels of society, and it even happened at the higher levels of society, and one could even see the elite, the white Spanish elite in the Valley of Mexico, get a little darker. As that happened, they became more obsessed with their own sense of purity, because by very virtue of their lineage, they were in power. So they sought to use a concept used in the Inquisition of limpieza de sangre, the cleanliness of blood, by which people presumably were to prove that they didn't have any Jewish or Muslim ancestry. In the Americas, this was used to prove you had no indigenous or African ancestry. African slaves were brought in to the coasts, the lowland coasts on both the Pacific and the Gulf Coast as labor, as those indigenous populations thinned out. And there was a place for them in this colonial order, too. There was the Spanish order, there was the Indian, and there was a place in the legal system for the African slave. But there was no place for this mestizo. The mestizo didn't belong. The first mestizos tended to be, well, they had a variety of experiences. There was the son of Hernán Cortés and Doña Marina, Martín Cortés, who became legitimized. He was legitimized by Cortés himself and became a Spanish aristocrat and absorbed into the Spanish aristocracy. The many more unlucky who had perhaps been products of one-night stands, of rapes, these were people that were relegated, mixed people who were relegated to the margins of indigenous society. These were the mixed reminders of a humiliation. They were the mixed reminders of conquest, and they had no place. So the original mestizo, the first mestizos tended to go either way. There was no acknowledgement of who they were, except that they were largely of illicit unions. They were largely, by 1530, the mestizo was synonymous with bastard. As society continued to mix, and as the Spanish elite continued to try to hold this at bay, there was a second sort of attempt to control this. Well, the two republicas didn't seem to work because people were mixing and blurring these lines. So at one point in the later colonial era, the Spaniards created a caste system, what they call the casta system. And you may have seen these in these gorgeous, perverse family portraits in a colonial Mexican painting, by which sometimes there's 16 compartments in which the race of the father, the race of the mother, and the race of the child are designated. And they're hierarchicalized by the extent of white blood that the person has. The higher percentage of white blood you had, the higher you were in society. You were a Spaniard, you were up here. And if you were the unlucky child of an African slave or an indigenous woman, you were down here. And the paintings were meant to be a cautionary tale, in a sense that you were somewhere in that scheme. You know that perhaps if you married this person, if you were a mestizo, it might behoove you to marry a castizo, the child of a Spaniard and a mestizo, to go up the ladder rather than an Indian, or certainly not anybody of African ancestry. So this perverse family portrait, for years by American historians, was thought to be the way things were in colonial Mexico. My God, the Spanish authorities really organized their society well. But it was a fantasy. It was a fiction. It was a fiction of the elite to think that they could control what was going on at the lower ends and even the upper ends of the society. The mestizo didn't have a place still, and they didn't identify themselves as such and organize themselves as a mestizo neighborhood or a mestizo guild. They sought to fit in where they could. Historian Charles Gibson labeled the colonial mestizo of Mexico a pragmatic opportunist. Eric Wolfe, the great late anthropologist, I believe he was at the University of Chicago, wrote this of the colonial mestizo. His chances of survival lay neither in accumulating cultural furniture nor in cleaving to cultural norms, but in an ability to change, to adapt, to improvise. The ever-shifting nature of his social condition forced him to move with guile and speed through the hidden passageways of society, not to commit himself to any one position or to any one spot. As the Spaniards moved north, this erosion of the racial system happened more rapidly. The further you got away from the powers of the crown and the church in the Valley of Mexico, the more things that had gotten messy got messier. The people who went north were not the people with status in the Valley of Mexico. There were very few Spaniards moving and settling places like Los Angeles or San Antonio. We know now, if you go see the list of the pobladores in the plaza here in Olvera Street, you'll see that the percentage of people of African ancestry among the pobladores. And we know that these people had a sense of racial malleability to them. Because in essence, a strict rigid racial system, which collided, or the other way around, rampant mixture, which collided with the strict racial order, produced a sense of racial malleability, racial and cultural malleability among the mestizo. So as they came north, you could see it in the first censuses of Los Angeles. Between 1781, the first census, and 1789, the number of people who changed their race is remarkable. In 1781, a certain Jose Vanegas says he's an Indio, he's an Indian. By 1789, his status had changed in his mind or in a material sense, but by 1789, he was a mestizo. Now this order, this fluidness, this racial messiness, if you will, then came in contact with another racial system that was moving west, the Anglo-American racial system. This was a system that was premised on the notion of purity, and it was a system that was premised on the bifurcation between black and white. And from the very beginning, this system had no idea what to do with the Mexican. From 1850 to 1920, Mexicans were de facto whites on the census. In 1920, in response to a nativist movement that was seizing on a law, the 1924 law, that made anyone entering, made immigrants ineligible to become citizens in the long run, could not even enter the country. And if only white people, and then, but through amendment to the Constitution, black people could become citizens by 1920, by the 1920s, to then recategorize Mexicans as a Mexican race was a way to delegitimize them, to allow them not to enter the country. The other reason, one reason for their de facto whiteness was that a white person was a person who was not black. But there was another reason for this. There was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And the treaty said that those who stayed, the 75 to 100,000 Mexicans or Spanish speakers who remained in the territory that was conquered and in the territory that was annexed to Texas, that if they stayed 1 year after the signing of the treaty, they were eligible to become U.S. citizens. Then, if only white people in the mid-19th century could become U.S. citizens, and Mexicans were eligible to become U.S. citizens, so then therefore, they were de facto white people. So, in 1930, Mexicans, as I said, had been designated. If you were born, as my father was, in Los Angeles County, his race says Mexican. And then there was an interesting little tidbit, a wonderful historian at Santa Barbara found, Mario Garcia, that the city of El Paso, and imagine this, at one point tried to turn itself into a spa, into a health resort. So in order to make the city look a little bit more salubrious, they decided to play with the racial the health statistics, and if they took the Mexicans out of the white category, the health statistics for whites would get so much better. What this then engendered was a strategy, the first Mexican-American civil rights strategy, and as some scholars have called it, the other white race strategy. it's sort of funny, actually. And the response to this attempt was to call a congressman in San Antonio and to fight for the right to whiteness. If one's rights in America were conferred by your ability to prove that you were white, then one fought to be white. By the late 40s, the famous Mendez versus Westminster case has been heralded recently. The U.S. Postal Service has issued a stamp commemorating. There's been some op-ed pieces in the L.A. Times. But what no one mentions about that case is that Mexican-American advocates were not suing to end segregation. They were suing to end segregation against them. Segregation has nothing to do with us. We're white people. So this strategy had its faults, and presumably maybe it had gains here and there. But by the 50s, we had instances in which a famous court case in which a Mexican-American had been convicted of murder, and his judge went to, rather his attorney went to the judge and said, my client did not have a jury of his peers. There were no Mexican-Americans on this jury. And the judge said, well, let's see. Mexicans are white, and the jury's all white, so what's your problem? It is funny. The advent of the Brown versus Board and the advent of African-American civil rights strategies changed all this and began to change all this, that it became noticeable, and it became Mexican-American advocates became aware that it would behoove them to be identified as an identifiable minority on some level so that the government could protect their status. At the same time, initially, they didn't want to be identifiable minorities, but if it meant losing their whiteness. The race-based strategies of the 60s, the Voting Rights Act, affirmative action, created an enticement, an inducement for Mexican-Americans to claim non-whiteness. So, by 1972, this people who had long, whose advocates had long insisted they were white, were now insisting they were non-white overnight. I've written this, I wrote this, and it was republished by the Christian Science Monitor. I got the awful email saying that words in Spanish that I can't repeat there because this is a... But I'm not saying this to say Mexicans are horrible people. I'm saying the system was horrible. And they sought to use this system for their benefit. Who could blame them? My argument is that Mexicans have not fit into the racial system. It's not known what to do with them. And so they themselves have gamed the system at any given moment to be on the black side of the divide and in the white side of the divide. I argue furthermore that now that the confidence with the numbers, the confidence in political gains has led more and more Mexican Americans to say, let's not be analogies. Let's not fight to be on one side or the other of the racial divide. We are brown people. We're mestizos. We see that after we saw after the 1980 census, and we remember all the fine print, Hispanics can be of any race. The first data that came in, and I have some colleagues who were present among the census demographers, that said that essentially the Mexican origin people of California, just pick on California, about half claimed to be white on their census, and the other half claimed other. Because remember on your census questionnaire, there's the ethnic question, are you Hispanic or not Hispanic? And then there is the racial question, are you white, black, Asian, Native American, other? The first data that came in, the census demographers were befuddled. Like, why? These people are white. What's wrong with them? Why don't they just say they're white? The problem persisted in 1990. The problem persisted in 2000, to the point where census officials for the 2000, thinking about the 2000 census, are thinking of actually of eradicating the other category. So to force Mexican Americans and other Latino Americans to pick a race already. Now, I argue that if you have millions of people choosing E, you have A, B, C, and D, and then there's E, millions of people choosing E, it ends up invalidating the entire system, not only the entire system, but the actual each discrete category itself. And the Census Bureau is actually worried about this. This is one reason that my essential thesis of the book is that in the same way that the mestizo, the rise of the mixed person who didn't belong, and by the way, I forgot to say vagabonds, because they didn't fit into the legal system in colonial New Spain, they often roamed the roads as vagabonds because they didn't have a place in the Spanish city or the indigenous small town, the indigenous pueblo. So as the mestizo destroyed the Spanish racial system, colonial racial system, I'm arguing that the coming of millions of mixed people, half of whom seem to have a sense of that mixture, will end up destroying the Anglo-American racial system. That it will forever change the way we see race. As I was finishing the book, I found this, it was literally the last 10 pages, and I was about to like jump out a window. I found that the primary testimony, the most convincing testimony to the House subcommittee that oversees the census, when the census was considering before the 2000 questionnaire to allow Americans to choose more than one race, it was a gentleman by the name of Carlos Fernandez from Berkeley, an activist. I've never met him. Apparently he had a Mexican father and an Anglo-American mother, and he had read Mexican history. He had a sense of the challenges and the opportunities of mestizaje. And he thought that there was one of the gifts that Mexicans could bring to the United States, this sense of racial malleability. And he helped change and broaden and make our census data. Has anybody seen it for the last 7 years? It's very messy. It doesn't add up to 100 anymore. Mexicans, and in Mexico, haven't figured out mestizaje. Mexico, and I had to go back a little bit, has not really gotten over its conquest. Its dysfunctional Genesis myth plays out in its culture, in which officially their Indian past is heralded, but we know in the Mexican society, whiteness is favored. We just have to turn on the TV every night. And Mexico hasn't really dealt with this, but what it has done is create a large body of literature and intellectual ponderings of the meaning of this mixture. Again, this challenges its opportunities, and Mexican-American intellectuals have adopted this tradition. John Philip Santos, who talks about the mestizo codex of our DNA. Richard Rodriguez has written perhaps the most elegantly about the same subject. But it's really a Mexican and a Mexican-American tradition. And so whereas America is mixing on its own, and somebody referred, Tavis Smiley, I think, referred to me during an interview as the Tiger Woodsization of America. It's hard to say. What Mexicans are doing are hastening this process, not the immigrant generation. Immigrants, like always, tend to enclave. They tend to hunker down and find people like them and find networks and sources, again, of meaning, back to my utilitarian definition of culture. Places how to get jobs, places to live, connections to back home. But the latter generation Mexican Americans has shown very different behavior than the immigrant generation. The first big study, and I don't think there's been anyone perhaps as good since, was the 1963 study that ended up in a great book, classic 1970 book called The Mexican American People out of UCLA. And as early as 1963, a third generation Mexican American had a greater chance of marrying an Anglo than a Mexican, a first generation Mexican. That right now we're seeing, and this is not about intermarriage per se, this is about adaptability. This is about people who have been painted as preternaturally loyal to culture and resistant to change, when in fact, historically, the opposite has been true. Historically, they've been willing to sort of embrace. They don't throw away their Mexicanness. No immigrant who did that. But they found ways to maintain their Mexicanness and adapt new forms. There's wonderful research you find as within weeks of arriving, Mexican peasants in the 19-teens were loving their jeans, their denims. There's stories of the number of Mexicans who owned trucks, or vehicles, rather, in 1920s Texas. Mexicans adapted, and Mexican-Americans have adapted. Today, in California, two-thirds of interethnic, interracial unions involve a Latino. So not only are Mexicans and Mexican-Americans hastening the mixing, the Tiger Woodsization of America, they're giving a language to it. Miscegenation, you may recall, was a nasty word. It was a vulgar term. Race mixing was a vulgar concept not that long ago in America. In a beautiful article on Louis Steinman, who runs the Allowed program on Sunday, you may have seen it, Jim Newton, my boss, by the way, used the word mestizo without defining it. In the Los Angeles Times, you can say mestizaje, racial and cultural synthesis, without it being defined, without a comma before and after it. And Mexican Americans have lent this word to the English language. And it's not only not negative, it's not only not vulgar, it's normative and perhaps a little celebratory. That this sense of mixing is a sense that we're helping to bring to America. I had dinner the other night with a brilliant man, Walter Russell Mead, who just wrote a book called God and Gold, America and Britain in the Making of the Modern World. And I hate it when people understand my work better than I do. And over dinner, he essentially said, Gregory, what you're arguing, and you know, he said, what you're arguing is that Mexican Americans are helping America become a bit more American. And that he said it better than me, but the way I put it is, we have a melting pot tradition that we have heralded in America, but it was a melting pot tradition that was exclusive to ethnic whites. It was about ethnic whites. Even Israel Zangwill, the British Jewish playwright who popularized the notion of the melting pot in his 1909 play, which premiered with Theodore Roosevelt on the balcony, 7 years later, in part because of pressure from some prominent rabbis in New York who were offended by his notion of that crucible mixing, Israel Zangwill himself said, I didn't mean gamic interaction. I meant a spiritual, cultural miscegenation. So this melting pot that we've heralded has been exclusive to whites, And Mexicans bring another sense of a melting pot, and that's racial mixing. So it's this ethnic white mixing now being superimposed with the tradition of racial mixing that broadens our notion of the melting pot, broadens our notion of American identity, American inclusiveness, and what it is we claim to be searching for in a country that really clearly has yet to perfect its own ideals. I think I'm done, so thank you. After I read my emails, I will pick some. I did that in a bookstore in Washington, and the woman was so offended. It's like, it's a total defense mechanism, so don't mess with me because I have my trio. Sir. Yeah.
Just a comment about the Census Bureau problem. And Native American to a lot of people means a member of a tribe recognized by the United States government, which is within what are now the boundaries of the United States, and maybe some Canadian tribes. A lot of people wouldn't consider a Mexican Indian to be a Native American as that term. The other problem that you bring, so a person who is Yaqui might feel that he couldn't count himself as Native American. The other problem is that practically anybody with any black blood, certainly with a 16th of African ancestry, can proudly call himself African American.
Or will be called by others African American.
But by law, you can't call yourself an Indian unless that your tribe has federal recognition.
Right. There was an interesting, if I may, since it wasn't a question, I'll pretend like it was. There was a case, a very sad case recently that I only read Yahoo News now, right, because that's pictures. That's a joke. I subscribe to the Los Angeles Times, as should you. But there was a really poignant, sad case in Kansas recently, in which a non-federally recognized, and non-federally recognized Indian tribe started selling fake IDs and memberships to undocumented, largely Mexican immigrants. And to further my point of Mexican sort of racial malleability, they joined. and they joined, and it's sad because they were being duped, they were being ripped off, but they were willing to change their status, they were willing to change their racial status in an attempt to improve their living conditions and their legal status in the United States because this fake tribe was promising them if you became a member, you could become a citizen in the long term. It was a horrible scam. This gentleman here. Because he was smiling throughout the lecture, I'm trusting you.
I enjoyed it tremendously, thank you. I was on a tour of the Ruta Maya, seven cities in the Yucatan. One thing that struck me, there's a monument in Chetumal of a mestizo and a Spaniard. Is that approximately the area where you were talking about, where the mestizo was born? And then in Merida, there is, at the governor's mansion, this image on the mansion of the Mayan gods and the Spaniards standing over that. Have you seen that monument?
I've never been to Merida, ever. But are you done with your question?
Yes. I'm just curious about those images.
I'm happy to know they exist. I've only read about them. Now, if you go to Mexico City and you go to 57 Higuera Street in Coyoacán, where we went, this is Doña Marina's house, her 16th century house. And there is no plaque there to designate this mythic mother doesn't have anything commemorating her existence. And if you try to find any sign of Cortes in Mexico City, you will look hard, long and hard, and find a small bust of him in a basement, I believe, of a hospital he founded in the 16th century in central Mexico City. So most of Mexico's my sense doesn't acknowledge that mixture in a healthy way. Right here.
Hi. Oh, did you mean?
No, you first.
Okay. Your writing and your discussion to me conjures up a lot of the similar writing of Richard Rodriguez, which you mentioned. Mm-hmm. One concern that I do have is that Richard Rodriguez has, in some ways, embraced a very postmodernist view of identity. For instance, he has claimed that he is Chinese.
Is there a question here?
Yes. The question is, so what exactly are you projecting in terms of racial categories? Are you projecting that they will become obsolete? Are you, and if so, what are perhaps the dangers of that, given that racial categories do in some ways, despite the fact that race is a social construction, racial categories do have a role to play in terms of understanding continued persistence of racism and what have you.
Right. So, one, I don't know what that has to do with Richard, but let's move on. Richard wrote The Myth of Poetics. He inspired me. He gave me my first job. He introduced me to the woman who gave me my first job, my first writing job. And I wrote the logistics. I wrote out the logistics of who screwed whom, if you will. I don't mean to be nasty, but it is a nasty history. It's a nasty history of collisions and convergences. It is a history of conquest, but presumably it's also a history of love and attraction and the making of a people. And I've tried to match those mythopoetics with facts as we've culled them from libraries. Now, your second question, I'm not advocating anything. I'm not prescribing a thing. I've been asked the same question before, I think in Chicago, in Austin. And I think my answer would be this. I don't think we should ban racial categories. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we should let them erode naturally, and they will sort of ban themselves. When people polemicize things, you only revive them. If there's an attack on categories, there will be groups who will defend them. Now, my problem is that after the 2000 census, we did see this presence of people who chose more than one race. And that my problem was the extent to which that threatened interest groups. And we know now, because of civil rights monitoring, that a person who put black, white on the census would, for the purpose of civil rights monitoring, be recategorized as black by the government. That is problematic, because it's become understood to be one of our rights as Americans to choose our own identities. And so the government choosing our identities for us to protect us is problematic. And if that continues to go on, that is something that has to stop. That let America mix, and let America see what it becomes of itself. The new census is crazy confusing, and that's good, because so is this country. Yeah.
It's so fascinating, the idea of, in a sense, re-examining a foundation myth and even proposing, you know, a new one. Could you talk
arrogant, isn't it?
Well, I wonder if there's a tradition of that, and out of what tradition does that come, and how might it... how might it actually affect that change in consciousness? I mean, have you looked at that among others? Are there others who have tried to do this or attempted or thought in those ways, I guess?
No, I received a really beautiful email from a therapist in Mexico City who read my article. And she thought this could, in many ways, be used to counter the inferiority complexes that so many Mexicans have written about. We know that the seminal work, and again, Richard was part of a long tradition of this writings. José Vasconcelos wrote the Raza Cósmica in the 1920s, and he did so, and a romantic, terribly confusing work, but what he was trying to do is sort of herald a new era of mixing, of a mixed world, and Mexicans were the herald, the beginnings of that new world. And his attempt, although he denied it, was to really give to chip away at the sense of Mexican inferiority. So he was trying to say, you are not, you know, in a world, in a Western world that prizes purity, wait a second, you are the future. And we've seen Carlos Fuentes write about this in a quick manner. Again, other people, John Philip Santos has done it. A variety of people have attempted it. Now, familiarity with other official changes, I'm not talking about official changes of Genesis myth, was in Romania, where I spent a miserable month once. And Ceausescu had insisted that they were not of Roman ancestry because that was imperial. modern day Romanians like to call themselves Latins in a sea of Slavs. They watch Mexican soap operas and revere Italians. But under the Ceausescu regime, it was a brutal, you know, cult of personality dictatorship. He chose to tell his people that they were Dacians, that they were the indigenous people of that area, not the Romans. So plenty of people have played with it, and I'm not suggesting that. I'm not actually asking the government to do anything, but it would be great if we taught this story to people. It's a beautiful story, and it's striking that it's there. I didn't invent it, and not that many people know about it.
For the 2000 census, I marked white Hispanic. When was that introduced, and what was the political impetus for that new categorization?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
the question? For the 2000 census, I marked white Hispanic. When was it introduced for the census, and what was the political impetus for it?
I don't know. I do know that I think it was 1980 when the official Hispanic category appeared, and I think that's when it was differentiated between the ethnic and the racial. I think it was 1980, the first census that said Hispanic can be of any category. Presumably, it was to allow for the variety of racial experience within the black Puerto Ricans or Cubans. But presumably, that was the impetus. But I don't think anybody foresaw the use of the other so prominently, the other category. There's one thing I forgot in my notes. I had four words on it, and I forgot one of them. Sorry, if I could. During the war of Mexican-American War in 1846 to 1848, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I'm compulsive about this. The Americans were winning so rapidly that there was a movement in Congress to take all of Mexico, but there was one problem that the Congress had to talk about. Well, who are we incorporating if we take all of Mexico? And that's where the introduction of the initial use of the mongrels and James Buchanan, President Polk, Secretary of State, and later to be President of the United States, was quoted, "How should we govern the mongrel race which inhabits Mexico?" John C. Calhoun, the great senator from South Carolina, harangued from the Senate floor, "The downfall of Spanish America was its inability to separate the races properly." So one of the things that offended the Anglo-Americans, at least in the Congress in the mid-19th century, was the hybridity of this people, was their mixture. That was an offensive notion to them. By the 1920s, my favorite anti-Mexican congressman, and I say that sincerely, John C. Box of Texas, argued that we have to keep the Mexicans out because this mongrel people will lead to the distressing mongrelization of America. And my book is here to prove that he's right. So anyways, back to questions. Yeah, here, please.
This country was also founded on the notion, you know, accepting the whole foundation on slavery in response to European class system. So as we see these racial and ethnic categories presumably erode, do you foresee then that the United States, and as part of our political culture, we finally accept that there are big differences in social classes as well?
Well, I do. It's a great question. I think at the end of the book, I discuss what happens in majority Latino places in the Southwest, and I discuss the Harlan in Texas and El Paso. That when you have a majority Mexican place, and remember, and maybe step back a little bit. When the Anglo-Americans moved west, one of the first things they did in the territories and new states was to outlaw interracial marriage. The only state that did not in the Southwest was New Mexico, because there were significant numbers of Hispanos still in power that refused to vote in favor of anti-miscegenation laws. So having said that, I believe that what we see in places like El Paso, a late county supervisor in El Paso, who I wrote about him, and Sam Huntington put it in his book. He thought that was a bad thing. This man, his name is Pat O'Reilly. I think I called him once afterwards, and I think he got hit by a car while he was riding his bike, and the man died. But in any case, he left this great quote in El Paso, and he said, "Here in the valley, we're all Mexicans." And what that does is, in a sense, it leads the political divides to be more based on class. race becomes less of a signifier in a place that has these, in which the majority change. And in fact, we see that the part of the region of the country with the highest percentage of intermarriage is the region of the country with the most Mexicans, the Southwest. That there is again this malleability and this openness to mixing.
Hi. I grew up in Mexico, and I moved to the States in '87. And one of the things that I found extremely amazing about Chicanos is the obsession they have with race. Whereas having grown up in Mexico, I never knew that I was part white, that I was part Indian, that I was a mixture of all this stuff, because I have a French last name.
Right.
In fact, I didn't even know my last name was French until all I Mexicans came here. And so
all Mexicans say they're French, buddy.
No, I am. And so, you know, I had classmates, the last name was Savludovsky and Poniatowskas and what have you. Right. But race was never discussed, or the fact that, you know, their ancestors came from all. In fact, the only person that has ever mentioned where he came from is Vicente Fox. And nobody gave a shit about it.
Please edit that out, Russell. Thank you. Great. Thank you. Oh, the gentleman next to that man who just spoke. The Frenchman.
You mentioned that...
I knew you'd be here. Thanks.
Thank you for letting me ask a question. One of the reasons why Americans did not want to invade or take over Mexico.
All of Mexico.
All of Mexico.
They ended up choosing, getting the deal with the most amount of land with the fewest number of Mexicans.
why, in terms of the miscegenation, why did not it not happen in the United States?
It did. We just denied it. That's the point. It did. I mean, we know that some estimates of upwards of 80% of African Americans have white blood. It did, but our racial system didn't allow that. The fiction of white purity, the fantasy, was for them to remain pure. And so the mixed people, it's right? I mean, I do mention in the book, there's an interesting point, another point where the sort of the, what I call the Hispanic Catholic racial view and the Anglo-American Protestant view collide is in New Orleans. Now, under the Spanish and French, there was a three-part system. There was whites, there was black slaves, and there was free people of color. So, but under the Americans, as they came west after the Louisiana Purchase, that three-part system, as we know now, was compressed into a two-part system. You see, I mean, there was no allowance for any diversity among blacks. We know Homer Plessy in Plessy versus Ferguson was something like 1/20th black. I mean, he was chosen to be the test case and the legal precedent because he was so light-skinned, but according to the law, he was black. Yeah.
Could you relate what you've been saying to the people who are living further south than Mexico? What would be the...
I was asked that in Washington because there's lots of Salvadorans. It's a good question, but I don't know the answer. My book is about Mexicans, and it's the largest immigrant group in U.S. history. Which nobody writes that. It's just surpassed Germans only recently. It's the most continuous immigrant group and immigrant wave in the history of the United States, and it's the most contemporary, the largest, and not only the largest undocumented, it's the largest legal immigrant group to the States. So no, it has a particular precedent and importance unto itself. And Mexican origin people make up 2/3 of all Latinos. And the next biggest Latino group is Puerto Ricans at 9%, to give you an example. And the next biggest Latino group is Cubans at 4%. So Mexicans, and in California, it's something like upwards of 80% or more of Latinos in the state of California are of Mexican origin. However, you will have noticed that the more Mexicans there are in the United States, the less you'll hear the word Mexican. Except for those people south, that we chose these generic terms which have some sense to them, and there is a certain shared cultural values among people of Latin American ancestry, but we've tended to give in to these generic terms, and I think it's really hindered our ability to understand this group, because you keep on saying, I wrote a piece for Newsweek upon the election of Mayor of Yaragosa, the front page, you know, the picture of him on the beach. And I wrote a piece about Mexican Americans and da-da-da, and the editor in New York had to put three paragraphs in on Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and everyone else. And I said, I don't know anything about them. And he said, I'll write it. So he did. Yeah.
Outside in the hallway, there's a painting display by James Gurney, a science fiction writer, and just one of his paintings really spoke to me. It was his fantasy of a university. Obviously, a library is one place of higher learning. Here we are. Do you have any particular fantasies about what you would want to see in a place of higher learning?
What an odd, cool question. I wasn't much of a student. I went to Berkeley, and I spent all my time working at bookstores, and I sold newspapers at Dave's Smoke Shop, and I worked at Moe's, Cody's, University Press Books. Right. So my education was actually borrowing books from my employers and getting their discounts. So that was my ideal education. I didn't go to class much, but I read a hell of a lot.
This is a real quick one. Have you?
Where are you?
Here.
Okay, sorry.
Hi. Have you seen Tony Gleaton's exhibit at Loyola on the Black Mexicans?
No, I saw the review. I mean to go see that. Yeah.
It's wonderful, and it's on until the 18th of this month.
Thank you for that plug.
It would fit in with your discussion.
Is it an easy column that I can whip out in like 2 hours?
Yeah.
Now you know my strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, go see it. I recommend it highly.
All right, thank you very much. One last question. By the way, I have a book for sale outside. If anybody might want to look at it.
I teach at a high school. We have about two-thirds, we call it Latino enrollment. Mm-hmm. What I have noticed is that towards senior year, there's a flowering of Latino identity as the kids struggle to get into Harvard and Yale and Stanford. And sometimes middle names like Leon, which were never part of the enrollment sheets earlier in the high school, emerge as important parts of the personal essay. Do you think that this influence on youthful identity by academia is part of the program that you want to see go into effect, or is it perhaps actually going in the wrong direction?
Oh, I'm not asking for any program to go into effect, but your story proves the point of my book, that the sense that, you know, hey, if you want me, if never, I'm not going to even say it. God bless them. That's all I got to say. You know, it's really hard to get into big colleges these days. So I have a very good friend of mine, and this is a story I use, and I hope nobody can identify her. She is a Filipino, Irish, Mexican Jew, and she has a young son in Los Angeles. She's in the Valley, and here in Los Angeles, the magnet schools, the best public schools, whites are the minority. So you know what she puts for her son? White, because it's an affirmative action category. So, you know, we don't see any complaints about that, oddly. But it's a similar story, but a different twist. So thank you very much for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay at Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KCET, and LA 36. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.